This is a podcast by Young China Watchers. We're a global network of young professionals with 10 chapters around the world. In this episode, we're listening to a virtual event organized by our London chapter. They invited author and conflict resolution expert Tim Clissold to discuss his book, Mr. China. 15 years after its publication and almost 30 years after the events, Tim's memoirs still serve as a primer for anyone wanting to do business in China. With Michael Yip, head of the London chapter, Tim discusses how China has changed and how we should adapt to that change. This podcast is an excerpt. The full webinar is on our YouTube channel. I hope you enjoy listening.
Greetings, everybody, and hello from Glasgow, where I'm speaking to you from. My name is Michael Yip, and I'm the head of the Young China Watchers chapter in London. I'm really pleased to call upon Tim to introduce himself and to say a few words about his exploits and his book. Tim, over to you.
Great. Thanks very much, Michael. Just by sort of brief introduction, I was originally from the UK and I did physics at university for reasons that I've completely forgotten. And when I was in my mid-20s, I was actually sent by the company I was working for to Hong Kong. And I arrived in Hong Kong and I was immediately tremendously struck by it, by its energy. So within about 3 weeks of arriving in Hong Kong in 1987, I went over the border to Guangzhou and I was just completely amazed by it because it was in the time when it was still the state-run economy. So normal relationships are like completely inverted. So as a customer, you had to kind of be incredibly polite and ingratiating towards a shopkeeper, for example. So when the time came for me to return to the UK, which is in 1988, I decided to take 3 months off. So I went to Pakistan and then up through the Karakoram Mountains into Xinjiang. I followed the Silk Road through Urumqi and then down into central China. So I went to Xi'an and Chengdu, Chongqing, along the Yangtze, right up the coast through Beijing and then out across Mongolia and back through Russia. So that was in 1988. So when I got back to the UK, the newspapers were full of how great Russia was doing and it was all sort of perestroika and glasnost and so on. And I just had an instinct that was the wrong way round because China was just so much more active. I then decided to take time out of work and I spent a couple of years learning Mandarin and then ended up in China in the early 90s. Through a series of coincidences, I met a Wall Street banker who wanted to start a direct investment business in China. And we managed to raise about $400 million quite quickly and then invested it in about something like 20 joint ventures all over China and got ourselves into the most tremendous trouble because we'd assumed that business in China would function in the same way as the West. And of course it doesn't. So the book that I've written, Mr. China, is basically about that process of raising a large amount of money, investing in China, and then this sort of slow, queasy feeling rising up in the pit of our stomachs when we start realizing it's all going terribly wrong. And then the story of how we kind of sorted it out.
Thanks, Tim. And conscious that some joining on the call may not have had the chance to read that book just yet, would you give us a quick overview of its key messages?
So I actually wrote the book to make sense of what has happened to me. So I've never really sort of thought of it as having any kind of overt message, other than just through the story, which is that, you know, if you go to China, you have to adapt to a civilization that has been tremendously robust over vast periods of time. So I actually think the best way of looking at modern China is not through the lens of communism or, you know, is it going to become more like the West? The way that I try and understand China is looking about the much deeper trends that actually took place, you know, in imperial times. A lot of the things that are going on in China are quite explicable in that sense, but not in Western terms. So I suppose, you know, if there is a message at all, it's that if you go into China expecting it to behave in a Western way, then you can get the shock of your life, which, of course, is exactly what I did.
This book has been read really widely. It's encountered critical acclaim. I appreciate that at the time it was an introspective process for you, but are you by any chance surprised by the learning value, the educational value that flows from the book, even today?
Yeah, my passion is to try to explain China in a way that sounds credible to a skeptical Westerner, because, you know, we're going to have to learn to coexist with Asian societies, and Asian societies at the heart of Asian societies is China, And as I said earlier, it's an incredibly robust civilization that has a very well thought out set of values and philosophy. So, you know, if I can have any contribution to some better understanding or some mutual appreciation between East and West, then that's something I'd be, you know, thrilled about.
You spoke about your innate curiosity to explore China. Explain to us whether at any point whether you had any doubts about being someone that was immersed in China.
I doubted it all the time. You know, we went and did the best possible job we could do, and then it kind of unraveled. Basically, all the incentives were misaligned. The incentives of the Western investors and the incentives of the local Chinese management weren't aligned, and that led to conflict. So just a little example, I can remember once negotiating with a factory manager, and his salary was ridiculously low. He was in a remote factory in Sichuan, and I wanted to increase his salary by a factor of four or so, because that's what I've been mandated from the US, because, you know, there it's about financial incentives. And the guy absolutely wouldn't take it. And of course, that makes no kind of sense in our society. But he was a man that was leading a group of people, about 1,000 people, all of whom were on very, very low wages, in a much more closely connected local society in a fairly small town, some, you know, in Sichuan, making motorcycle wheels. And he genuinely felt that if he took this enormous salary, it would just start to break the cohesion of that little local society. So I could give you hundreds of anecdotes like that, where actually the behavior on the part of the Chinese was tremendously human and understandable, but it was just in a completely different kind of set of incentives and a different sort of social set of mechanisms. And I found that tremendously difficult to explain to the American side, because it just sort of devolved down to the normal kind of tropes where, you know, the Americans say, well, you know, all the Chinese are stealing things from us. And the Chinese are all saying, you're insulting our national dignity. So you had to kind of strip all that away and actually try to get to what the real meaning was. All the Americans wanted to do is see some sort of return, but it had to be done in a way that was sensitive to the realities of these individual factories.
In the same breath, the high points. And here, please, tell us about some of the more recent work that you've been doing as well, and some of the successes. So
the high points are the corollary of what I've just said. So at the moment I do dispute resolution, going to a situation where you've got a Chinese and a normally American, sometimes UK businesses, where the relationship is completely broken down. What happens is I work with a Chinese partner. So he will go and see the Chinese side. Whoever it is in charge of the Chinese partner will basically shout for 3 hours. And then next day, this Chinese guy, my Chinese colleague, Frank, will go back and the guy will shout for 2 hours. And then the third day, it'll be like 1 hour. And then I will arrive and they'll probably shout for 2 hours there. Because they're absolutely furious about something that's normally a proxy for what the original argument was ever about. And then you go and talk to the American investors and they're all, you know, banging the table and everything. Basically, what you have to do is you have to let both sides express their emotions, empathize with the emotion, and sort of nod your head and say, yeah, the Americans are quite unreasonable. And then on the other side, you say, yeah, the Chinese are pretty unreasonable as well. Once you've let people vent their emotions, the most difficult part is getting both sides to have some emotional acceptance that they were responsible, partly responsible for the cock-up, whatever it was. Then it all comes down to a question of numbers. So you can have the slightest click like that to slightly change the aspect of what they're arguing about. And then they all go, oh yeah, that's fine. And then you get a settlement. So when that happens, that is a real high.
You appear to have the natural skills of a diplomat. Did diplomacy not tempt you at all?
Two reasons. I'm afraid, you know, it's not very fashionable to say, but I was motivated by money when I was younger. So I'll be completely honest about that. And I absolutely wouldn't have the patience for diplomacy, where you have to basically say things you don't really think, because you're representing something that's vast, yeah, and you're just a tiny sort of cog. So I've always sort of really wanted to kind of act, and then make some mistakes maybe, and then when all the rubble kind of falls to pieces, you just pick it up and try and put it back together again. you can't do that if you're the UK ambassador to China. You can't do that. You can't really afford to make mistakes. And I think even now I'm not terribly frightened of mistakes. If your real intention is right and people can say, oh, okay, he's made a mistake, you can normally recover.
Tim, one question that I know you know that I'm interested in asking is centered around the human relationships that you've made during your time in China. During those times of intense pressure and difficulty, you probably forged some very deep and very strong relationships with some of the characters. Are you still in contact with them?
So I did forge very strong relationships with the people that were kind of on my side, as it were. But the thing that I'm even more proud of is that I forged quite strong relationships with people on the other side as well. There were two particular individuals. So one was the guy who had a rubber seals factory. I think his net worth is 800 million US equivalent now. And I saw him probably 5 years ago and I hadn't seen him for a while. And he got up and he walked around the table and he came around, he patted me on the head and he said, Tofa Baila, your hair's gone white. So that's good. And then the other one is the woman who was my kind of opposite number at the five-star brewery. So I think I call her Madame Wu in the book. She's actually called Madame Jo. That was very gratifying as well, because I saw her about 6 months ago. And she's now very elderly and she's definitely not well. I think she's right at the end of her life. And we just sat, and it was like we just sat calmly in a tea house. And we talked about how life had been. And she said to me, when I first knew you, you used to negotiate from the point of view of principle. But after a few years, you used to negotiate from the point of view of practicality. And that to me is just, that is the basic difference between East and West in my mind. But it was very moving because I'm very fond of her. I mean, she was absolutely appalling at the time. I couldn't deal with her at all. But there's a real human being behind that, behind the facade of this highly turbulent chief engineer, there's also a mother, right, who cares about her son, yeah, and she's got a family and all these other things. So that's been gratifying. And it hadn't worked with all of them because, some of the people that we came up against in China really were very selfish and really did steal money and really did damage businesses that then led to 1,000 people not having a job. So, I'm not in touch with them. But that was definitely the minority, and you get those in every society.
The world is immeasurably different to how you portrayed it in Mr. China, and I wonder whether actually it might be ludicrous to suggest the opposite, which is that the opportunities and the risks fundamentally remain the same in some way, insofar as China is still a basket of wonderful commercial opportunity, still a place that's got great political complexity. I wonder if you could just make a comment on that.
So I completely agree with that. What I think has really changed is China's position in the world. And this is something I don't think people in the West really grasp yet. There was a report by the Brookings Institution about 18 months ago. So it said that in between 2015 and 2030, consumption by the global middle class will increase by $29 trillion US equivalent, essentially a doubling. The thing that is really striking is out of the 29 trillion increase, only 1 trillion will occur in the US and Europe. So that is an absolutely fundamental reordering of the way that the world works. And then, of course, if you drill down into the numbers, it's basically China. The role of China in nucleating this colossal change in economic activity from West to East has tremendous consequences about the way that the West should design their strategy over the coming decades and how we should view China. It is having a massive, major, fundamental effect on the way the world is developing. We've got to get used to that.
You can't ignore, however, the intense upheaval that's taking place in the arena of international relations, especially vis-a-vis China-India, China-US, and in spite of the great commercial opportunity, business opportunities, would it not be defensible for someone to shy away from taking up that secondment in Beijing or taking up that research post in Shanghai, going to China to study as you did during just after the Tiananmen Square protests, when, again, seeing great political upheaval as well?
So I think that's a very kind of individual, personal thing for people to think about. But these things are fairly transient in the scale of things. Try and think, what's the world going to be like when you're my age? Right? Because if you get into the position where you've kind of evaluated correctly the way the world is changing, you've got an enormous tailwind behind you. And, you know, because of the statistic I've just, you know, mentioned earlier, I think there's a huge tailwind behind China. When I first went to China, I can remember I did kind of gulp going there, because I came after I'd resigned. It was in London. I came out of the office and there was a newsstand, and the headline on the Times was "Peaking in Flames as China Slides Towards Chaos." Okay, so that was about the 6th of June or something. Right. So, and you know, so yeah, it was bad for 3 years or something, and everyone knows what happened afterwards. The second thing is that the Chinese have made it their business to understand the West. So the problem now is they know more about us than we know about them, and that puts us at a disadvantage. Obviously, I'm very passionate about China. I love China. I like being there and so on. But I'm from the UK. And I'm very proud of this country, and I love this country as well. But we have so much to learn, and we haven't made the effort. And I find it tremendously frustrating. So, for example, I have spent something like 7 years trying to create a new A-level about Chinese civilization, because there's nothing in the A-level syllabus about China. It's completely mad. You know, you've got the largest change that has occurred in our lifetime is globalization, with China at the center. We're leaving the EU, and then we just say, well, we're not going to teach the next generation about China. So it's complete madness. So I created a syllabus by consulting with 10 universities. I went and personally interviewed 9 vice chancellors of the best universities in the UK, put a package together, took it to the Department of Education, had a meeting with the schools minister, and they just said no. So I think that, you know, we have to improve our game on China. I think that we as a society could learn something of tremendous value to ourselves by looking at other societies and the way that they do things differently, and doing what the Chinese did, which is basically saying, right, well, we'll do that bit because we think that might be useful to us, but we're not going to do this bit because it won't work here. Obviously, having said all that, I think that everybody has a duty to go to China and understand it and then come back and preach about it here.
Tim, it's fairly controversial, though, isn't it, to be an advocate for engagement at an educational or an academic level. But I wonder if you'd make a comment on engagement at the level of sensitive industrial or business decisions. I mean, I've got a question here from Ken who wants to ask you about the Huawei and 5G decision. The UK has made a decision to disengage.
Yeah. Yes.
What of that?
We have to, number one, we have to be ruthlessly honest with ourselves about why we made that decision. The head of GCHQ and the head of MI6 said that the security aspects were manageable. Okay, and then there was an enormous pressure from the US, and the decision changed. I think that as a society, we have to be extremely honest with ourselves about why we did that. There's 170 countries that think that they can deal with that security risk, and we can't. That is a perfectly valid decision to make. The point is that if we disengage, it will have consequences, and we therefore risk being passed by history. That's the risk, and we have to be really honest about it. Valid decision, it has consequences.
Just want to switch tack very quickly. We've touched upon politics and international relations for the past couple of minutes. So I want to draw your attention to Giovanni's question, which focuses on dispute resolution and investment. I mean, I'm just going to read out his question very quickly. A quick question on conflict resolution, especially when it comes back to reporting back to the American sides. Those kinds of discussions sometimes come across as a bit disingenuous. The assumption often being that investors wouldn't be able to understand the situation on the ground in China. or wouldn't be able to stomach them if they did. Do you think this is still the case, Tim?
No, not really. It's not a question of not being able to understand it. They can understand it, even if it's in their own paradigm. It's sometimes it's just holding your nerve. So give you an example. I'm publishing a third book, and it's going to be published by the commercial press in China. That contract's already been fundamentally breached four times. We haven't even published yet. So the contract's kind of not the relevant part. The relevant part is keeping the interests aligned so that both sides get what they want in the end. So I think that that is more difficult in a Western context because we're so sort of inculcated with the concept that a contract is a contract and it has to be fixed. And if it isn't fixed, we can go to a court of law and we can force it to be implemented. And that's sort of the most fundamental thing about the difference in China. And of course, that's bad. I mean, the fact that there isn't independent implementation of law in China is a huge weakness. But, you know, I can't see how they're going to sort that out for a long time.
Does that have a cultural basis with the differences in culture that we're seeing between East and West? And with China's international expansion, we might see changes in culture.
The Chinese state is arguably the most robust human institution that has ever existed in human history, because it's not far off the same as it was in the Han. So if you go to the tomb of the third Han emperor, the first exhibit is a diagram of the Han state and how it's essentially the same as the current structure of the Guoyuan. So there's tremendous robustness in that system because it's been tried and tested. They're just very practical. You know, they will import ideas like stock exchanges. They don't regard it as a huge clash to take a small amount from a Western society. Whereas here, you know, if we adopted any kind of, you know, working that was vaguely part of, you know, the Communist Party of China, it's like the entire panoply would just collapse because, you know, we have this one idea. So the whole thing is going to disintegrate.
I've just got a question here from Crystal again. Touching upon China's political response to criticism in denying and locking down. Yeah. I mean, what about that?
Absolutely right. So the way that I look at it is that there's been a breakdown of trust between China and the West. So I do think that China is very, you know, far too touchy. But there are all sorts of reasons for that. And I mean, we all know about the kind of humiliation suffered in, you know, in the 1800s and so on. So, you know, there's that, but, you know, come on, guys, get over it. I think there's a tremendous yearning in China for them to be better understood and not necessarily agreed with and not admired as the greatest civilization on the planet, but just a little bit of interplay both ways. So I'll give you an example. In most middle schools in China, it's now compulsory to study Shakespeare. Conversely, basically nobody knows about Du Fu or Li Bai or any of the other great Chinese poets. So in April, you might know, in April there was a BBC 4 documentary about Du Fu. And it had Sir Ian McKellen narrating translations of Du Fu's poems, right? So even though it wasn't broadcast in China, it went viral there. So within a week, there were 2 million hits. And then it was on national television. It even had an editorial piece in the People's Daily. That, to me, indicates a tremendous yearning to be better understood. This, you know, this marvelous, brilliant civilization that's kind of basically just dissed. I mean, no one would like that. I went into a Rumchi station last year. There's a bookshop there. It's full of Socrates, Kissinger, Dickens. So there are all these kind of things. I remember going into a bookshop once in Beijing, and there was a book by Nietzsche, right, which most Westerners would never have read, right? So I said to this friend of mine, does anyone read Nietzsche? And he said, oh yeah, it was really popular when I was at university, right? So there's a massive imbalance in knowledge. That's what I think the core of the problem is. And it doesn't mean to say we have to agree with what China does. Absolutely doesn't mean to say that, but there's tremendous literary value in Chinese poetry. There's tremendous value in its art, tremendous value in the technologies that it discovered in glassmaking and ceramics, all these other things. So if we just knew a little bit about that, rather than just focusing on, just absolutely focusing on basically the human rights issue, that would make them a lot less uptight. And then you could start having a human conversation.
Tim, I'm conscious that you do have a book in the pipeline. Would you like to say a few words about it before we sign off?
So, okay, that'd be a bit embarrassing because it'll sound as though the thing that I was talking about before was a plug for my book, and it wasn't intended to be that at all. So about, I've written a book about Chinese poetry. So it's completely different from anything I've written before, and it will be published inside China, not outside. So it's basically, it's a foreigner's take on Chinese poetry. And the reason why I wanted to do that is because Chinese poetry is not otherworldly. It talks about basic human experiences of like falling in and out of love, getting drunk, sailing down a river on a boat, that kind of stuff. But if you dig down deeper, it also talks about social inequality, tax evasion, the effect on the environment of excessive logging. And all these thoughts are coming from about the 700s. And I find that tremendously reassuring about the shape of a human life and what our concerns are, because they haven't really changed since the 700s. So that's why I wanted to write it. And I found it completely unpublishable in the West. So I'm publishing it in China.
No doubt there you'll encounter better success. But in time, in the West, if we're to be open to new cultures and new ideas, as you say we should be, perhaps here in the West too. Hopefully, in a not too distant future, we can all meet together and discuss your book on poetry and goings on in China in person. Stay well. Bye.
Bye.
That was Tim Clissold, author of Mr. China, and Michael Yip, head of Young China Watchers London. The full recorded webinar can be found on our YouTube channel. Go to youngchinawatchers.com to find out about upcoming events, read interviews with China experts, or replay one of our webinars. My name is Sam Colomby. The music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions.